Hey, I'm Johanna Wagstaff.
And hi there, I'm Rohith Joseph.
And we're asking for 10 minutes of your day to go through the 10 things that the UN recommends we can all do when it comes to climate change.
Please don't leave.
No.
And also, the things aren't new.
We are just wired to not do them.
We promise you to help you figure out your brains, and you and your people can make better choices to combat climate change.
10 Minutes to Save the Planet is available now on CBC Listen and everywhere you get your podcasts.
This is a CBC podcast.
Hello, I'm Neil Kirksall.
And I'm Chris Howden. This is As It Happens, the podcast edition. Tonight.
Disarming Candor Part 1. He was the first to publicly refuse his mandatory military service for political reasons after October 7th. Tonight, that Israeli teenager tells us why he is prepared to keep going to jail rather than join the IDF.
Disarming Candor Part 2. Nicaragua takes Germany to the International Court of Justice with the ultimate goal of ending German arms exports to Israel.
One for the ages, a group of older women win a landmark case when a court agrees that Switzerland's climate policies violate their human rights. One of those women tells us how she's celebrating and that she was also fighting for generations yet to come.
It buckled and now they are buckling up. The work of clearing the wreckage of Baltimore's Key Bridge has begun. The U.S. Army engineer in charge of that operation tells us it is as delicate as it is dangerous.
A truly riveting performance. When he started improvising, he had a frog in his throat. When he stopped, he had a frog in his name. And the song he'd invented on the spot made the late Clarence Frogman Henry a legend.
And taking their cues from one another. They started out as a couple of rival pool players, but after years of giving each other a hard time, one wound up giving the other a kidney and saved his life in the process. As it happens, the Tuesday edition, radio that's glad they stayed together for the kidneys. Benjamin Netanyahu says a date has been set for the IDF's invasion of Rafah. The Israeli Prime Minister made the announcement yesterday, and today he met with new recruits, telling them, quote, "This is a very significant day in your lives and in the life of the state," unquote. Not that they have much choice in the matter. National military service is mandatory for all Israeli citizens over the age of 18, with a few exemptions on ethnic, religious, physical, or psychological grounds. Tal Mitnick is not subject to any of those exemptions. So when the 18-year-old became the first person to publicly refuse conscription for political reasons after October 7th, he was jailed. Then he refused again and was jailed again and again. And in a few days, he'll go back to prison for a fourth time. We reached Tal Mitnick in Tel Aviv.
Tal, how does one prepare to go back to a military prison for a fourth time?
I need to refresh my soap bottles that I bring. But apart from that, it's mostly a mental preparation for, again, going back into this place where a lot of the times I can feel alone. And kind of changing the way I speak a little bit about certain subjects, because usually when I explain it in language where they don't have the instant connotation with, oh, he's a leftist, oh, he's against the occupation, mm-hmm. usually they are pretty sympathetic to what I say.
Mm-hmm. If we go back in time to December when you first did this, I was reading that a teacher had told you even before that, when you were studying math and computer science, that you were so smart, you would be great, you know, in an elite intelligence unit. So even well before October 7th, you were thinking about whether this was something you could do. Why did you decide to object?
The reason why I decided to object publicly is because I realized that I have this privilege in my society and I want to use my privilege for good and not take advantage of it to boost me up in the social hierarchy of the Israeli society.
When we talk about late December, just a couple of months, you know, after the October 7th attacks, what was the reaction like there to your decision?
It wasn't very nice. A lot of mean messages and a lot of threats, but all from people online not showing their faces or showing their faces. So it doesn't really scare me, because I know that my message is right and my message stands for human rights. And I'm also fighting for the same people that send me those threats. I'm fighting for them to have safety, to have security, and to not have to live in a constant war zone where people are dying left and right.
You are one of three Israeli teenagers to do this publicly for political reasons since October 7th. It hasn't changed what is continuing to happen on the ground. It hasn't ended this war. So do you think it can actually make a difference that three young people in Israel take this step?
Honestly, I don't know if me refusing is going to end the war. But what I do know is that my refusal, a lot of people have seen my refusal, a lot of people have been impacted by it. And it makes me happy that people can see another side, another way to do things. Mm-hmm. And I know for a fact that my refusal has caused more than a couple people to think twice about their enlistment.
So you think there are many more people than the three of you, that's Sophia Orr, Ben Arad, and you there. You see that there are more out there.
Yes, definitely. The fact that they're not publicly out there talking about it doesn't mean that there aren't more people that are getting exemptions that may seem like they may be mental health exemptions or physical exemptions, but the real reason behind these exemptions are political and ideological motives. And I have also people that I know that enlisted into combat units, and we disagree on a lot. But because they have gotten to know me as a person, they defend me, and they know that I'm doing what's right for me, and they respect my decision.
Why do you think you're only one of three who have decided to do this publicly? It's still a rare choice.
The system of apartheid, the system of occupation, does not only affect the Palestinians. It is also a violence against Israeli society from the inside. If it's militarism, if it's a social hold on what we see acceptable, seeing the army as this golden goose that can't be touched, that can't be talked about, it really has a strong hold on Israeli society. And sometimes it's hard to go out of this box that has existed for 70 plus years. But I think that the time passes, and just last year we saw with the judicial reform protesters that this golden goose, the army, the service in the army, was a little bit broken. And I see that as a positive thing. And I expect more and more people to start doing this.
In the aftermath of attacks like the ones that happened on October 7th, though, that kind of resolve can strengthen, and that focus on security and military response can strengthen. What do you think it will take to shift opinion and shift political decision-making?
I think that the idea that you said of security after October 7th has to be broken. We, as the Israel has a pretty strong army, and still, somehow, on October 7th, Hamas was able to commit this horrible terrorist attack on Israeli civilians. And that is, what we've been saying for years, that the army is not bringing us security. The only thing that will bring us security is demilitarization and coexistence with the Palestinian people.
There are people, no doubt, listening here and elsewhere where our show airs, who feel very connected to Israel, go back to Israel, and the stability of Israel is crucial to them as well, even though they live here. And so many of them have been backing, Israel's military actions. What do you say to people abroad who are worried about Israel's security and safety in the world?
The security of us and the security of Palestinians, it's intertwined. We can't just have the security of Israelis. We can't just have democracy for Israelis, for Jews. I really feel like the whole idea that security is brought by military force is just, we can see throughout history that it's not true. And I invite the people that want to work towards Israel and Jews' security to come here and to fight for it, to fight against the fascist government, To fight against the radicalism inside the government, and also the radicalism of Hamas. But right now, we need, as an Israeli, I am focused on changing what's happening inside of Israel, and I believe that that could bring a change to what's happening in all the region.
Tal, thank you very much for your time. Take care.
Thank you.
Tal Mitnick is an 18-year-old conscientious objector in Israel. We reached him between military prison terms in Tel Aviv. Elisabeth Stern has some celebrating to do tonight. Ms. Stern is a member of Senior Women for Climate Protection Switzerland, or Klima Seniorinnen in the original German. The group has been arguing that Swiss climate policies are not up to snuff and are thus contributing to things like heat waves that are having a disproportionate impact on older women, like themselves. Klima Seniorinnen fought through the Swiss courts before taking their case to the European Court for Human Rights in Strasbourg, France. And that's where Ms. Stern was today, as the court, in a landmark ruling, found that Switzerland's climate policies constituted a violation of human rights. We reached Elisabeth Stern in Strasbourg.
Elisabeth, how have you been celebrating?
How I have been celebrating? I have been celebrating by answering tons of media requests. I have not had the chance yet to celebrate, but we are hoping we can do that tonight. That by 8 o'clock, we decided this is it. No more interview requests.
We just snuck in. That's good. Thank you for making time. You were in the courtroom today, is that right?
Yes, I wouldn't have missed that for anything. Yes.
Did you have any doubts before the decision came down?
Oh, well, you never know. You just never know. I personally felt really like a kid waiting for Christmas, and then you had a gift, you wanted, and is it going to be under the Christmas tree or not? And I am just by nature an optimistic person, but that's maybe not even the right term. But it was just wonderful.
It sounds like that term applies, and it's the correct one. But at the center of this case, your argument, along with your colleagues, is that climate change is hitting older women like yourself particularly hard. How has climate change affected you?
Well, first of all, when I was a kid, when we had 3 days in a row, 30 degrees, we got so-called haying holidays so that we could help at home with the haying. Yeah. And of course, then we could go swimming instead of haying. But this happened only about twice during my school years. And now it would happen every summer. You could send kids home for 3 weeks because we have more than 30 degrees. And how does it affect me? I don't take it well, the heat. I cannot function. I cannot go out. I stay home in my apartment. I can keep 24 degrees. That's very nice. I definitely don't go shopping during the day. And when I'm, like 2 years ago, I got caught when I was on the way with the public transport. And it was so hot that I felt I'm actually going to die. I will never live to the end of this trip. And I never want to experience that again. That was so, so unpleasant. Mm-hmm. And many of us women, I'm now 76, and I have been noticing it for the last 2 years, not before. And for some unknown reason, evidently, women take heat less well than men. I mean, older men suffer also during these long heat waves. But then there are more elderly women who even die during those times. And why that is so? Because men sweat more, so they get more heat away from their body, and for some reason women don't. So the evidence is there, but not quite the explanation yet.
Not everyone, even if they agree on issues of climate change, they may not see it as a human rights issue. How do you convince people that it is a human rights issue?
Well, I can say we have Article 2 and Article 8, which gives us the right to health and life. And climate policy we have in Switzerland, by the way, in many other countries, just is not in line with that. the way we are going, together with other countries, we are on a track of 3 degrees global warming. So, yes, our right to health and life has been violated. The court today has said that's true. Climate protection is a human right.
I wanted to ask you what happens next. You know, what are you hoping, apart from the headlines and all of the interviews, practically speaking, what do you hope this decision in court will achieve?
Well, practically, I hope that the Swiss government will now do its homework and a bit faster than up to now. That's one thing. And I do hope also this decision has sort of maybe a bit more even than a ripple effect in other countries. And if people there know, oh, actually, you can you can make your government be better in terms of reducing CO2 emissions and so on, then, yeah, they can take up their course.
I'm struck by the different generations coming together in a way in response to this case. We know the Swedish activist Greta Thunberg, you know, said that this was only the beginning. So much of the conversation on climate change and activism is looking forward to future generations, making the world safer and better for future generations, which of course is important. Yes. But I wonder if you and the others who were part of this case felt left out of that conversation and why you felt it was important to show that it's impacting you.
I don't think we felt out of the equation or the discussion or so. It was just very clear that we wanted to do something to contribute, because you can only complain at the court when you are personally affected. And so this was sort of like the reason that we could even go to court, because we were personally affected, we elderly women, and that is actually the reason why we could do it.
Your experience was your strength.
But it's not the narrative we changed also about older women. At the beginning, we were sort of like these funny women, these merry women and so on. Why don't you just sit in a rocking chair and knit something? Huh. So as we definitely have changed that narrative here in Switzerland.
Elizabeth, thank you for your time.
Okay, thank you.
Elizabeth Stern is a member of Senior Women for Climate Protection Switzerland. We reached her in Strasbourg. When you're playing pool in a bar, things can get dangerous. And when beer is flowing, bets are being made, and the trash talk heats up, a harmless game can get nasty. But for competitive pool purists who aren't drinking or betting, just the promise of a prize, not to mention bragging rights, can contribute to things getting out of hand. 10 years ago at a pool tournament in Maryland, James Harris Jr. and Russ Redhead solidified a bitter rivalry when James beat Russ for an all-expenses-paid trip to an international pool tournament in Las Vegas. And given that contentious relationship at the time, there was no way they could have known that a decade later Russ would donate a kidney to James, saving his life. We reached James Harris Jr. in Glen Burnie, Maryland, and Russ Redhead in Lebanon, Pennsylvania.
Russ, I'll start with you. When people say bitter rivalry, what are they talking about here?
So when me and James first met, we were at a pool tournament, and James like came out swinging. And so I was like, wow, I'm like, there's no way this guy's rated what he's really rated. And then I said it. I made a big Facebook post about it and everything, and some people that were James's friends started sticking up for him and started more or less like attacking me. And I was like, whoa, I'm like, maybe I did make a mistake. Maybe this guy was just shooting really well that day. I don't know.
Yeah, we can laugh about it now because obviously it's turned into a friendship. But what was that turning point, James? How did it go from really, you know, trash talk is maybe not even strong enough, but how did it switch into a friendship?
Maybe 6 months after that. We met at a local tournament in Maryland, and that's when he apologized to me.
You really just were that good? He had to admit it.
Yeah, I just had a good day.
And James, as that friendship is developing, as you're competitive pool playing is continuing. You're also dealing with kidney disease. What kind of toll was that taking on your life leading up to the transplant?
It was tremendous with the dialysis, 3 times a week, 4 hours at a time. Like 8 surgeries I had with due to complications. Sometimes it's great. Other times you're sick. Anything can get out of balance, let alone how dangerous the dialysis session could be, because it puts a lot of stress on your heart, and then you got to be careful with infections. Yeah. So it's just tiresome, but pool is what got me through.
Yeah.
You know, I would play pool on the weekends. I was on disability, so I was blessed enough to be able to rest during the week. I didn't have to try to work.
Yeah. So a transplant obviously would be life-changing. Russ, how does it come to be that you're a match and you're in a position to donate?
So it kind of came as a surprise to me, because I thought he was doing fine. He showed no signs of, like, you know, slowing down or anything like that as far as I was concerned, because he still shot pool great and whatnot. But James is the kind of person who kind of, like, hides everything and keeps things to himself. So I was at a pool tournament and talking to his wife. She was telling me about his condition and everything, and I was like, really? I'm like, that's crazy. I, like, would have never known. So then she was telling me about, like, what I asked her. I said, what does it take to donate? Like, what are the requirements and stuff? And as she was going down the list, in my head, I was just thinking, I'm like, okay, check, check, check. You know, like, I can do that. I can do that. Yeah, I'm good with that. At the end, she thought I was just trying to be, like, intuitive or wanting some information. I was like, but in my head, I was thinking, I'm like, if I can do it, I will. And I was like, well, I'll do it. She was like, you'll do what? She's like, you'll do what? And I said, well, I'll donate, or I'll do whatever I got to do to help him out, you know?
And
she just started bawling, crying. And I was like, it's okay, you know? And I gave her a hug and tried to console her a little bit.
Let me bring James back in. We heard how Denise reacted. Was it Denise, your wife, James, who
yes.
told you what Russ was offering?
She made a Facebook post, a big write-up saying that I was in need, but Russ didn't know anything about the post. It just came from them talking. Yeah. And I had family members that went through the process, which is you have to pass a lot of medical tests to even be available to be a donor. So I didn't want to get my hopes up too high, because people said they would do it, and then they would either, most of them didn't back out. They were denied because of one reason or another. So I told her to keep that private, because I didn't want to know about, you know, who was going through the process until they actually made it where they could possibly be a donor.
And when he did, so how did you react?
I was excited, but again, I couldn't get too excited, because the surgery could be stopped at any time, right up like a week before the surgery actually took place. We did about 20 tubes of blood to do a final match test, and we both passed that. So that's when it started getting, you know,
real.
Yeah, a little more real.
So the transplant did happen on February 8th. How are you doing now, James?
I'm doing well. I'm probably at 90%.
That's great.
It's still healing, but we were pretty much at about 60% right after the surgery.
And Russ, how are you doing?
I'm doing a lot better. I'm pretty much almost back to 100%.
You had to get T-shirts, too.
Well, that was Denise. Yeah. Denise, you want to go ahead and tell that?
Oh, hi.
Oh, hi, Denise. Yeah,
hi. Okay. So, yes, so about the T-shirts, yes, I got them from Etsy, so I was able to order them, and it was a surprise. So the night before the surgery, they were playing pool, so I presented both of them with the T-shirts and said, okay, you have to wear them. So they were like, ugh. But once they put it on, they were like, you know, walking around all proud.
I bet. You know, you've... James in particular, and Denise as well, you've been through so much. What is this experience? Where has it left you, James? How are you feeling?
It was a life-changing event for me. From some mornings, a lot of mornings being sick, fluid restrictions, So that's all changed for me. I feel great in the mornings, where on dialysis you would wake up always tired. But all that's changed. It's just a life-changing event for me.
Well, James, Russ, Denise, thank you all.
Absolutely.
Thank you.
James Harris Jr. and Russ Redhead are former pool rivals. We reached James and, surprise guest, his wife Denise in Glen Burnie, Maryland. We reached Russ in Lebanon, Pennsylvania. The singer tells us, I got a voice, I love to sing, I sing like a girl, and I sing like a frog. And then like magic, he does just that. Promises made, promises kept. The song is called Ain't Got No Home, but it's had a home in people's hearts since it was released in 1956. It crops up in the movies Diner, Stand By Me, and Casino, and in cover versions by The Band, The New York Dolls, and Buddy Holly. But the story of the song began late one night in a New Orleans barroom, where the band had played every song they knew and the crowd still wanted more. So the young singer improvised the song's trademark vocals on the spot, switching between a sweet falsetto and an amphibian croak. That's how he got the nickname that stayed with him for the rest of his life, Clarence Frogman Henry. Mr. Henry died this week at the age of 87.
Hello, I'm Jess Milton. For 15 years, I produced The Vinyl Cafe with the late, great Stuart McLean. Every week, more than 2 million people tuned in to hear funny, fictional, feel-good stories about Dave and his family. We're excited to welcome you back to the warm and welcoming world of The Vinyl Cafe with our new podcast, Backstage at The Vinyl Cafe. Each week, we'll share two hilarious stories by Stuart, and for the first time ever, I'll tell you what it was like behind the scenes. Subscribe for free wherever you get your podcasts.
Today in The Hague, Germany defended itself against accusations that it is participating in a, quote, ongoing plausible genocide in Gaza. The case was launched by Nicaragua, which is asking the International Court of Justice to order Germany to suspend military aid to Israel. In its opening arguments yesterday, the Central American country argued that its own history of successfully pursuing U.S. reparations at the ICJ made it a logical interlocutor. And in its initial defense this morning, Germany invoked its own uniquely relevant history.
Germany has learned from its past, past that includes the responsibility for one of the most horrific crimes in human history, the Shoah. This explains one of the principles upon which our foreign policy with regard to all Middle East issues rests. Our history is the reason why Israel's security has been at the core of German foreign policy. In her speech to the Knesset on 18 March 2008, Germany's then Chancellor Angela Merkel spoke about Germany's special historical responsibility for Israel's security as part of Germany's raison d'etat. Federal Chancellor Olaf Scholz reiterated this point in his speech to the German Bundestag on 12 October 2023. I quote, "Our own history, our responsibility deriving from the Holocaust, makes it our permanent duty to stand up for the existence and security of the State of Israel. This responsibility guides us."
Germany's lead counsel, Tanja von Uslar-Gleichen, speaking at the International Criminal Court today. Carlos José Arguello Gómez is Nicaragua's ambassador to the Netherlands and is leading his country's case against Germany. We reached him in The Hague.
Ambassador, part of Germany's defense today, as we just heard there, is informed by its own past. We heard the words duty, responsibility, and many people will understand what they're saying there and think it makes sense that the country where the Holocaust happened would be invested deeply and feel a responsibility to Israel's right to self-defense. What do you hear when you hear that?
Let me make or reiterate a comment I made yesterday before listening to the agent of Germany. I had said that it was very meritorious that Germany was conscious of its past and wanted to help the Jewish people, but that it should make a distinction between the Jewish people and the Israeli state, which is not the same thing. But now, directly onto what she said today, that Germany learned from its past. If that is true, what Germany should have learned is that when genocide is being committed, and in this case, it isn't being committed against Israel, it is being committed against the Palestinians, or there is possibility that it's being committed against Palestinians. So if they learn from their past, it should be to help the Palestinians.
We know the United States supplies most of the arms that are sold to Israel, more than 65%. So Germany is hardly the only country that offers military support. Why is Nicaragua focusing on Germany?
Well, in the first place, we have no possibility of going to the International Court against the United States because they don't accept the jurisdiction of the International Court. So that left other possibilities of other countries that were substantially helping Israel. And the second supplier is Germany. And we have ample jurisdiction to go against Germany, not only on the basis of the Genocide Convention, but also on the violations of international humanitarian law, which Israel is also committing on other issues.
Germany, as you know, maintains that it sends Israel military equipment of a, quote, subordinate or defensive nature, unquote. You know, they're saying that they see no artillery shells, no munitions. What evidence do you have to the contrary?
Well, Israel has a budget of $16 billion a year in military weapons. So if Germany is the second supplier, we're not talking a few $100,000 or a few $1 million. I mean, the interests involved there are enormous. Whether it's they even talked that it was for training purposes, some of the military aid given. Well, I don't know what difference there is between providing the arsenal of Israel and saying, well, these bullets are only for training, and these other bullets you can use for whatever you want. But the truth is that Germany can make any statement they want because we are not in the contradictory part of the case yet. When we reach the merits, then, yes, we can enter into a contradiction on all the facts.
Your case, we know Ambassador also condemns Germany's suspension of funding for UNRWA's work in Gaza. Germany today told the court that it has increased its contributions to the UN agency's work elsewhere and describes itself as the largest individual donor country of humanitarian assistance to Palestinians. How would you describe Germany's contributions?
So what I said yesterday, I can repeat now for you, is Germany has been listening from the Secretary General of the United Nations, the President of the Red Cross, all the organizations in the world saying that genocide is taking place. And Germany has acted as if they have no news of that. They haven't suspended any assistance to Israel. But would they simply say so of Israel, they immediately suspended the aid to the only organization capable, really, of preventing the famine and everything that's happening in Gaza.
When you addressed the court yesterday, you also invoked Nicaragua's past. There is, though, the reality of Nicaragua's present. As you well know, Ambassador, your country's government is under investigation currently by the United Nations for systematic human rights violations and alleged crimes against humanity. So is your country the right party to be holding Germany to account?
Well, I mean, that is a different issue which we can be discussing another moment. But what I can say is Nicaragua would probably not have brought the case if somebody else had done it.
I bring up the current situation because it does open the case and Nicaragua up to criticism. And are you worried that, I hear what you're saying, that can be a separate conversation, but are you concerned that that's going to take away from what you're doing at the court and what you're presenting?
Well, I don't think that the issue of Nicaragua is before the court. The issue in the court is issues and things that Germany is doing, which don't change whoever the state that is making that statement and offering the proof.
Ultimately, how are you feeling? Are you optimistic that what you're doing might actually save lives in Gaza?
That is our principal objective. when we were considering in what way we could help the Palestinian people, we can't help them more in a better way than in what we have experienced. We have experience in the international court, and that's why we had recourse to the court. Now, what we expect is not only a decision that will be of a effect for Germany, but it's going to be a decision that will be very important for the international community as a whole. I mean, whether these type of obligations can be enforced or if they are a dead letter. In other words, if the Genocide Convention says you have to prevent, but it's really just a say-so that nobody's going to force you to do. That is what is at stake here.
Ambassador, I appreciate your time. Thank you.
Thank you very much for giving me your time also.
Carlos José Arguello Gómez is Nicaragua's ambassador to the Netherlands. We reached him in The Hague. Engineers are used to challenges, but the salvage operation taking place in Baltimore is especially challenging, and a lot is at stake. You've likely seen images of the cargo ship pinned under the remains of the bridge it destroyed. Here's how an outreach worker for sailors described it to us last week.
Where the key bridge at one point commanded the skyline, now the container ship commands that same space. It's sitting there. The bridge is draped over it, and it's as if you took a chunk of highway, laid scaffolding over the top, and then just dropped it out of the sky.
Reverend Joshua Messick on this show a few days back describing the wreckage in Baltimore's port. Work is already underway to carefully take the tangled mass apart in order to free the ship, fully reopen the shipping lane, and it's hoped to find the remains of the three people still missing from the collapse. One expert told the BBC that the operation is like, quote, a game of Jenga you don't want to lose, unquote. Colonel Esty Pinchason of the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers is leading the salvage. We reached her in Baltimore.
Colonel Pinchason, what do you see when you look at this wreckage?
Well, I think it's hard to separate what your imagination is telling you and what we're seeing with 3D imagery under the water. When you look at the skyline and you see the trusses that are laying and going into the water, you can't help but think that that's just headed down and laying the way that you see it above. But what we see is a massive, cantilevered, mangled mess of wreckage that is contorted and extremely difficult to identify any kind of structural integrity. So we're going to have to remove that type of wreckage in a very different way because you can't identify locations to cut, much less rig, and then lift.
When you describe that, I mean, just as a layperson, I can get a sense of how difficult that work will be. But just take us through the specific risks and dangers.
So we're able to see how certain spans are sitting, but what you can't tell is how much stored energy is in there. And I try to explain it like if you're holding a spring in tension from both sides and then you're going to cut it, parts of the spring are going to snap back. And that's what you have in portions of the wreckage. So our divers are headed down in order to confirm the connections within the wreckage so that we understand if we're going to cut or lift, that we're not going to cause additional danger to the operators that are going to be rigging or lifting. And within every evolution that we conduct, we are going back and looking at how the wreckage reacted. Did it react the way we thought? Mm-hmm. And then we go back in and re-engineer how we're going to take on the next load. So the divers are going into very unforgiving conditions, and the visibility they have is only about 1 or 2 feet at best.
In addition to that intricate, dangerous, complex work that you described, there's also the operation to retrieve the bodies of the three men who were working on the bridge, who are believed to still be below the water. What is the sense about that recovery operation and whether you will be able to recover their remains?
So the recovery effort of our missing persons is an integrated part of the plan. While I know I was just talking a lot about engineering, we all see this as a combined mission. If there is even a shred of a chance that there is an area that we think needs to be investigated further after we scan after every list, and it's an area that we think looks like a vehicle or something that could be human remains, we are, we're partnered already with the Maryland State Police for those divers to go in and conduct the recovery operation. And I don't know if you saw, but last Friday, that's exactly what we did. That system worked, where they were able to retrieve this missing person and then resume the operation very efficiently. And we're all very aware that we're trying to bring closures to these three families that are still waiting to hear.
We also, last week on our program, we spoke about the crew that's still on board the ship working and the kind of stress that they're under. I can imagine it's hard to pinpoint a date and a specific timeline, but what do you see on that front? What is it going to take for that ship to be moved out from where it's pinned?
Yes, ma'am. So we're very cognizant of the crew. They're actually in very good spirits. They've maintained their creature comforts, their living areas. They have connectivity so they can reach back to home, and they're a part of the team. As far as schedule, right now, our aim is to have a limited access channel on the far side so that we can get some relief to the port, get some vessels back out. And as we continue to remove additional wreckage, we'll go deeper. We still have multiple efforts on the side of the vessel and being able to take the wreckage that is right in the center of the channel that is not so easy to remove with cutting. We're going to have to remove that with salvage buckets.
How are you doing, Colonel? This is a lot on your shoulders as commander for the Army Corps of Engineers. How are you handling it all?
Well, I have to tell you, every time I think about that, and it can be overwhelming, I see the team that we have. And this is our channel. It's our port, our city. We had these relationships before this incident occurred. And when we kind of sprang together, I mean, it's like you won't fail because you can't fail the people you're serving. And the outpouring of support and encouragement has been amazing. So for me, I am being very disciplined about sleep. And the other day someone interviewed me and they were like, you're probably not sleeping and they're doing this on no sleep. And I was like, you cannot do this on no sleep. This isn't like a short operation where you can surge for a few days. In order to not make mistakes, in order to get the engineering right, we have to be on our game. We have to be sharp. I love watching our engineers duking it out. I love hearing them argue and getting to the right answer. If they're apathetic and they're like, sure, cut it like that, that's a big red flag for me. I want them to show their passion and the devotion that they have for what they're doing because they're all in.
Colonel Pinchason, thank you for your time.
Oh, thanks for having us. Really appreciate it.
You take care.
Bye.
Colonel Esty Pinchason is the Baltimore District Commander for the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers. She's in Baltimore. Nearly 2 years ago, he went missing. Now, he's finally back home. And if he could talk, he'd say, when Peter Higgs was a young lecturer at Edinburgh University, he wrote a groundbreaking physics paper in which he predicted the existence of a new particle central to understanding how the world is constructed. It would become known as the Higgs boson. And in case it's not already clear that his prediction was a big deal, it was nicknamed the God particle. Professor Higgs made that prediction in 1964, but it would take almost 50 years for scientists to confirm the particle's existence, leading, belatedly, to a Nobel Prize. Peter Higgs died yesterday. He was 94. In 2013, he told reporters how he had learned about the Nobel.
I heard the news when I was returning from my lunch in Leith later in the afternoon, and I was walking along Heriot Row when a car pulled up across the road near the railings. A lady in her 60s or maybe 70 or so got out and introduced herself as a former neighbour and congratulated me on the news. And I said, "Oh, what news?" And so she told me that her daughter had phoned from London to alert her to the fact that I had got this prize. And I heard more about it, obviously, when I got home and started reading the messages.
How do you feel about winning the prize?
How do you feel about winning the prize?
How do I feel? Well, I'm obviously delighted and rather relieved that, in a sense, it's all over, because it's been a long time coming.
Peter Higgs speaking to reporters after learning that he'd won a Nobel Prize in Physics in 2013, and it certainly was a long time coming. A year earlier, Professor Higgs told the BBC about the hunt for the Higgs boson.
It's something, I mean, this is something I've lived with for a long, very long time now. It's now nearly 48 years since I did this work in 1964. It was another 12 years before John Ellis of CERN suggested that it was time experimentalists started taking an interest in what I'd actually pointed out in an added paragraph to a paper which had, in its first version, had been rejected. And I'd pointed out that characteristic of these theories was that there were these sort of residual spinless particles, and that's what became known as the Higgs boson. And then came the planning of the big machines to test it and really pin it down in all its detail. And that's the story of LEP and then the LHC and the ill-fated superconducting supercollider in Texas. And that program takes a long time. It takes a long time to dig tunnels and to design machines and get them going. So it's not surprising that it's taken a long time to happen.
Peter Higgs talking to the BBC about the hunt for the particle named after him, the Higgs boson. Professor Higgs died yesterday. He was 94. It's supposed to be one of the iconic images of the upcoming Paris Olympic Summer Games. Open water swimming in the Seine River. A triumph of human ingenuity over human waste, I guess. But now a nonprofit is sounding the alarm about the river's water quality. Recent tests show levels of E. coli much higher than recommended along parts of the Seine. Nevertheless, officials are adamant that a $1.5 billion plan to clean up the river will pay dividends and make the waterway safe for Olympians. Last April, Neil spoke to Dan Angelesco, a scientist who's tracking water quality as part of the cleanup efforts. Here's part of that interview from our archives.
It is a little bit strange, given that for maybe 80 years or so, swimming in the sand wasn't allowed because it was too polluted with essentially with bacteria and pathogens. So people would get sick from the river.
You know, the symbolism of this river, you know, it's part of the romance of Paris, certainly, until you start thinking about what's under that water or what's in that water. So just how polluted was this river?
The Seine River has been, you know, at the center of many novels, films, etc. There are films where you see cadavers floating on it. And so it was used essentially as the sewage conduit for the city for many centuries. And, you know, with the modern sewage systems, it became cleaner and cleaner. But then at the same time, you start to have much more urban development. So you have more and more people whose wastewater essentially ends up in the river.
What's the biggest challenge?
The biggest challenge is really reducing the amount of pollution that comes with the rainwater, right? So this is with whenever there is a storm, you have all this water that's polluted that gets in the river. And keeping that from happening, that's a really major challenge. So that's where you need to retain that water so that, you know, all the rainwater sort of is kept.
What do you think that moment is going to be like when you start seeing people swim in the Seine for the first time in a century?
Well, I think it's going to leave a lot of people perplexed that some are so crazy to be able to get into this river. I think that's going to be the initial reaction. But then people will get used to it and people will say, you know, rather than stay and sweat in my hot Parisian apartment today, why don't I go to the beach? And I think it will come. I think it will. People will get used to the idea, just like they got used to the idea of swimming at La Villette, the other site that opened in 2017. And I think it will become part of the, you know, of the Parisian routine. You'll have the Eiffel Tower, which is also something that hasn't been there forever, right? It was built at some point. It was supposed to be taken down, and then it has never been taken down, and it's there, and it's a symbol of Paris. This could become another symbol of Paris.
From our archives, that was Dan Angelesco, a scientist who's part of the cleanup efforts in the Seine River ahead of the upcoming Summer Olympics. When police in a Detroit suburb responded to a call about a stray dog, they had no idea just how far she'd strayed. Turned out to be more than 3,000 kilometers. Recently, that dog, a terrier mix named Mishka, was reunited with her owners after going missing last summer in San Diego, California. After wandering away, it's believed she was stolen and sold before ultimately being identified thanks to an implanted identity chip. Mishka is certainly not the first dog to go missing and be found under extraordinary circumstances. Last summer, Zach Hackett was hiking in the mountains near Breckenridge, Colorado, when he found Riley, a Shetland sheepdog. As he told Neil at the time, he could tell the dog was in trouble, but had no idea just how long he'd been in trouble. Riley had been missing for 5 weeks.
I was kind of walking through a clearing, and I heard, the best way I can describe it, is a yip. It wasn't a bark, and it wasn't a cry. A little yip of like, hey, I'm over here. Like, come get me. Come save me. I don't think he had enough energy to bark if he wanted to.
What kind of shape was Riley in?
I honestly believe that was his last day up there. Oh. He had no strength to move. He lost half of his body weight. You could see him shivering from 10 meters away. And he was pretty calm on the walk down.
How long of a walk was this?
It took about 2 hours. The terrain was pretty rough to walk through, lots of down trees and sharp sticks, and it was very steep. So it was much harder to keep my balance with him in my arms. Well, I was trying not to fall over and land on a stick.
Yeah, I bet. And you had to cross a river too, right?
Yeah, the last part of the journey when you get down is we have Blue River, and it's only about knee deep. But the current is very quick. I was very worried that, you know, without my balancing stick, my walking stick, because I obviously had Riley in my hands instead, you know, without that balance, I was very worried if I was going to be able to stand up across the river. If I were to fall and drop Riley there, I wouldn't have been able to save him. He would have been taken right down the river and I wouldn't have been able to catch him. That was scary.
I bet it could have gone differently, obviously. And then you watched him overnight, right?
You know, we don't have any 24-hour veterinarians, and we thought it would be okay to keep him through the night and take him first thing in the morning. And we just try to give him as much water as possible and just, you know, keep his body temperature where it needs to be and do anything we could do. We gave him a bath, and the next morning at 9 a.m., we kind of reassessed him and we said, you know, it's 9 a.m., we have to take him right away.
Before that, were you worried he might not make it?
Absolutely. I was very worried.
So you make it through the night, you take him to a local shelter. When did you find out that somebody, a lot of people actually, were looking for him and that he'd been missing for 5 weeks?
Everyone was kind of surprised that I found the dog, and everyone just gasped. And I looked up at our animal control officer, and she said, Riley's been up there for 5 weeks. My heart dropped, and I started bawling.
What made you so emotional?
Just nothing made sense. The fact that he survived that long, the fact that I found him, like the chances that I was even up there that day, it was just the whole situation was way bigger than me. And it just emotionally just took everything out of me.
I want to bring in someone now who was also certainly emotionally invested in finding Riley, his owner, Mike Krugman. Mike, how worried were you that you weren't going to get Riley back?
Extremely. For him to make it 5 weeks in one day in the mountain terrain that we live in is an impossible feat. And for Jack to be at that spot at that time was like a 1 in 10 million chance.
And what was it like to get that call?
Shocking, excited. I mean, I dropped everything and just took off for the shelter. I ran into the shelter. You know, they said, we need you to take him to a vet. And I rushed out, and I didn't even ask, you found him. I was in such a shock that he was alive. But he looked so bad. He was, you know, like 12 pounds, and he was 25 when he left the house.
How's he doing now?
He is back to ruling the house. He's the smallest of six, and he is the alpha dog by far.
Why do you think Riley ran away?
I don't know. A lot of friends over here helping me look said that maybe my wife needed company, and you know, because she passed away in January.
I'm sorry.
But I never gave up hope. He's a hardy little dog, but I mean, we've got mountain lions, coyotes, and bear in the area. And we live 4 miles from where Zach found him and 4,000 feet lower. Wow. And how that little dog got that far, I have no clue. And so I called Summit Lost Pet Rescue. They were hanging signs up on everywhere around us immediately.
Well, it's also remarkable because Zach had only just moved to the area, really. He was a newcomer and hadn't seen those signs. So, again, it just adds to how incredible this whole story is. But have you two had a chance to meet?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
He comes over, and he met Riley a couple of days after he rescued him.
What was that like for you, Zach?
For me, that was just the completion of the story. You know, I couldn't really rest until I got the good news about Riley. And as soon as I got that call, that was the completion for me. That was the happy ending.
Zach is part of Raleigh's life now, part of my life, and we've become friends. And, you know, to have a friend up in Summit County is pretty good.
Yeah.
I feel the same way. I feel very blessed. I'm very grateful to have him as a friend.
From our archives, that's Neil's conversation with Zach Hackett, who found a missing dog last summer in the Colorado Mountains, and the dog's owner, Mike Krugman. You've been listening to the As It Happens podcast. Our show can be heard Monday to Friday on CBC Radio 1 after Your World Tonight.
And you can, of course, also listen to our show online at cbc.ca/AIH or on the CBC Listen app, or, of course, wherever you get your podcasts. I'm Neil Kirksall.
And I'm Chris Howden.
For more CBC podcasts, go to cbc.ca/podcasts.